Sin acknowledges and pays respect to the owners of the land on which the House of Sin and Studios stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Sin also acknowledges and pays respect to the elders and traditional owners of the lands our content reaches, as well as the radio stations we broadcast from across the country.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're committed to.
I haven't flip-flopped. I said no originally, then I said yes, then I have said no, and I've stuck to it.
I didn't need to do this. I've already done a lot of wall for the election.
The English fought a civil war over this matter.
Don't deal with the nuance of the Canberra bubble.
I don't know what to do with it. We have so much money.
What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
Issues that perhaps may be controversial today, but 30 years from now, your children, your grandchildren are going to be thankful that you stood up for what was right.
Represent.
Represent.
Represent. You're listening to Represent.
From RMIT, this is Sin Media's political discussion program, Represent. You're with Lloyd,
Danny,
Viet,
and Johnny.
Global handball king and former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd is ready to send out 9,000 signed handballs across the nation to people who dare challenge him to a handball championship game and provide a prepaid postal satchel. On today's shows, though, we'll be talking about rich school, poor school. The ABC reveals the wealth disparity in Australia's education sector. Scott Morrison puts the Prime Minister of Tuvalu into tears over climate. Protests in Hong Kong and Infrastructure's Australia's congestion-busting report. Now, Kevin Rudd is known for much more than being the global handball king. I like to remember him by the apology speech and his part in the kind of nation's ongoing progress and narrative around reconciliation. Now, 44 years ago today, Gough Whitlam poured the sand through Vincent Lingari's fingers, representing a very symbolic moment in Australia's history, but representing something very real, Indigenous land rights. So I'd like to start today's program with a bit of a protest song, and a song that really captures that spirit of reconciliation. This is From Little Things, Big Things Go by Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody. You're listening to Represent on Sin.
That was From Little Things, Big Things Grow by Kev Carmody, and you are listening to Represent on Sin with Lloyd, Danny, Viet, and Johnny. Today, we're going to talk about the population growth at urban fringes and how it has stretched roads and public transport to capacity, Infrastructure Australia audit says. Now, this links into our discussion last week on infrastructure, on the call for more infrastructure investment to stimulate the economy. And a couple of days ago, Infrastructure Australia released their audit that pretty much said that the urban fringes, being Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Perth, are stretched to capacity in the road and transport infrastructure.
Needs. Yeah.
Demands.
And it lines up with what the Reserve Bank came out and said about we need to be putting more money into infrastructure to stimulate the movement in the economy, right? Mm.
Yeah, exactly. The audit said that we need to invest $600 billion over the next 15 years, $40 billion annually to meet the demands. And I'm not sure if there's a sort of like catastrophizing going on, but apparently we are coming towards a point where if infrastructure investment doesn't become, like, big infrastructure investment doesn't become the new norm, quoting here, then we will see a collapse in infrastructure because we just can't meet the needs of the population demand. So, I think we'll likely see a big spike in infrastructure at this point because it's just that just seems the way it's going. There's just no way to avoid it. We need a big spike in infrastructure investment to stimulate the economy, to meet population demands. What I want, what I'm interested in looking at is what aspect of Australia's infrastructure needs it the most? Roads and transport or social infrastructure being hospitals and schools? What do you guys think?
I think it's a... You need both because you need, firstly, you need the social infrastructure to be able to meet the needs of your growing population. So right now we are experiencing particularly a boom within the younger age brackets. And so there is a need for us to build more schools, which we will get to in a later segment. But you also need the roads and also the transport infrastructure to be able to get people to where they need to go, because it's no use building more schools if no one can reach it. And so while, you know, while social infrastructure, you know, is important, we need to have the roads and the rail and the transport to be able to get there.
Not to mention with our aging population, the way that it is, we're going to need a lot more investment in hospitals to meet the demand that's going to be coming up very soon in the near future.
I guess as far as the stimulus effect is concerned, it's really that ready-to-go infrastructure that's being proposed and is what we need in that stimulus sense. So things like roads, things that you can plan and build, well, the plans are usually there, you can build quite quickly and have an immediate economic impact, right? Congestion busting is usually the one that's floated around. But I guess that's where really the debate comes in here. I don't think, I think most people, unless they strongly want a budget surplus, but even those people support infrastructure spending. The debate then, of course, is, as you mentioned, what should the infrastructure be spent on? And I think in Melbourne, when it comes to that transport infrastructure, we see that debate being played out by kind of public transport options and road options. Infrastructure Australia, of course, has a kind of implicit bias. It's always going to propose that we ought to build more infrastructure because that's in its very nature. That's its aim, to promote infrastructure in Australia. And usually those suggested projects are road projects, things like WestConnex or in Victoria, the infamous East-West Link. So I guess my question would be, at what cost should we be building this infrastructure? Should we go out there and tear up Alexandra Parade, build a road just because, you know, for the stimulus effect and because it's proposed by Infrastructure Australia?
I think an important thing to consider in terms of infrastructure and particularly transport infrastructure is the idea of induced demand. So many transport academics have noted that if you build a road, okay, you might have that road that reduces congestion in the short term, but in the long term, people will see that, hey, there's a faster route, so we're going to catch that road, and then that road starts to pack up again, and then there'll be another transport body asking for another road to be able to take the pressure off the road that they just built. Whereas for public transport infrastructure, if you build, say, a new train line, great, that's a new train line through an area, but you can always upgrade capacity on that train line. And so particularly for those people who live in the western suburbs of Melbourne at the moment, particularly on weekends, you might know about this, is there are 40-minute trains on weekends. And now you have a train line, you have many trains that are just sitting in the depot, you can easily add capacity by just adding another train. You've already got the infrastructure there. You just need to add more services. So that's an interesting argument for public transport over roads. But as you said, Infrastructure Australia just has an implicit bias for any infrastructure, provided it provides economic benefits.
There's another issue when we look at an increased investment in infrastructure, not just in Melbourne, but across all the urban fringe, and I suppose anywhere in Australia. What we haven't really been hearing much of is the incredible lack of skilled, qualified labour to meet the demand. That is a big issue right now. There's not enough. Not even talking about civil engineers. It's more like the operators of the equipment, technicians, planners, everything. There's a huge lack of a qualified workforce to actually meet this demand, and that has been what has been holding infrastructure development back in recent time. And going forward, that's going to be quite a problem, I think.
Yeah, even today, with all of the rail projects in Victoria, the state ran out of gravel last year. And also, this demand for labour, it increases the price of these infrastructure projects. These infrastructure projects are already quite expensive, and the debt that the states have to take on to build these is something that we're going to pay off in the future. So, yeah, I think infrastructure is a good idea, but I wouldn't be so hasty because it's a significant cost. And those kind of figures, they need to be decided appropriately. Now, Danielle, you've got a song for us here.
Yes, so we're going to dive into a new song by Lana Del Rey. This one was written and released only a few weeks ago in response to the mass shootings we saw in the US on that weekend earlier this month. So this is Looking for America by Lana Del Rey. You are listening to Represent on Sin with Lloyd, Danielle, Gianni and Viette.
That was Looking for America by Lana Del Rey. You're listening to Sin Represent with Lloyd, Danielle, Johnny and Viette. Now, talking about infrastructure, of course, is more than just roads. It's more than just rail. And Johnny mentioned before, if you're listening to our last segment, that a big part of that is schools and hospitals. So let's talk specifically about schools. Now, there was a report by the ABC coming out this week, which was entitled Rich School, Poor School, Australia's Great Education Divide. Now, I think we should dive into this article because it's quite significant. So the ABC used publicly available My School data to track the income of Australia's schools. They then plotted this income onto a graph, and the graph shows you some stark disparities in Australia's education sector, not just between independent and government schools, but between all schools. Some schools fare better off, some schools fare worse off, and I always thought that most schools fared rather similarly, but no, the case is that some schools fare much, much, much better than others. So if we look at the graph, coming out in first place is Wesley College. So that's a independent school in Melbourne. It's quite prestigious, and it has an income of $104 million. But if we look at the average income of schools, that sits around the...
I've got a figure here. Yep. It's kind of in the middle. It's the lower middle. And it's a school called Sheedy Park Primary School in South Australia. And in contrast, their income for the year is only $2.8 million. So is that... what's the percentage there, Viet?
I'm not sure.
$100 million and then $2.8 million. So there's such a stark difference there between schools around this country. And you can notice the clustering of the graph gets quite large down the bottom. So you can definitely see there's a kind of an elite of schools that are getting these exorbitant amounts of money. And then there's kind of a bulk, little bulge at the bottom of schools that, by contrast, are getting in pittance.
Yeah, and I think the interesting statistic that this ABC article poses is that the top four schools that are listed, so Wesley College, Halbury College, Caulfield Grammar in Melbourne, and with Knox Grammar in Sydney, all four of them have the same amount of funding compared to the lowest 1,800 schools. And so to give you a perspective, the top four schools in the country, in terms of funding, have the same amount of funding compared to the lowest 20% of schools, which is a very interesting statistic there.
Yeah, and it poses a lot of questions. That midpoint of the graph where we see most schools, it's a cluster, it's reasonably representative. Government schools are there as well as Catholic and independent schools. But as you pointed out, Viet, at that top tier, tier, it's all independent schools. Mm-hmm. Now, independent schools may receive income from a variety of sources, the most obvious being school fees that are paid independently by parents who elect to choose to send those students to those to those schools. But they also receive subsidies from the government. Now, one thing that we should clarify here, and it always kind of distorts this debate I found about public and private schooling in Australia, is that on the most part, public schools receive their funding from the state government, whereas government funding for private schools, so independent and religious schools, they receive their share of government funding from the federal government. So you've got to look at the total amount of government funding in any of these debates. Now, first of all, let's flag our opinions. What do we think of the education divide and Australia's kind of heavy reliance on private schooling? Is it simply a matter of choice for parents, or does it create kind of a divide in Australian society that is quite significant culturally?
I absolutely think it does. This graph makes me sad and a bit ashamed of our school system, to be honest, because you can see, and as well, the article that we've been talking about that we definitely need to go and have a look at if you're listening once you get out of the car, it's got pictures of these schools as well, and you can just see some of the lower funded schools, literally, they're falling apart. There's infrastructure problems within the school of, you know, walls having massive holes in them and computers not working. And then you've got pictures of an independent school where they've just upgraded their recital centre that seats upwards of 300 people. And I think the cultural divide that creates in our society, it's not something I'm particularly fond of.
One thing that's happened recently that really, I think, has sort of shaped my opinion on this, and I should probably make that very clear at the moment, is in Shepparton right now, which is a low socioeconomic area, four of the high schools, they're the four public high schools, Shepparton High, Wanganui?
Yeah,
Marupna. Sorry, I pronounced that terribly. And Maguire College are all being merged into one super school by 2022. And this is copping a lot of rebuking from the community, specifically parents, because the only other option is private schools. And because it's a low socioeconomic area, they are being forced to put their kids into this super school. They will be forced to, because they cannot afford to send their children to a private school. So it might not actually be a matter of choice so much, depending on if you're in a lower socioeconomic area, you may not be able to afford to send your children to a private school.
It's interesting in this case.
Do you believe that... So, Viet, you're a trainee teacher.
Training teacher, yes.
Do you believe that the government owes parents choice?
That's pretty much the crux of the argument behind school funding in general and what led to the Gonski controversies of 1.0 and 2.0. So just to give a bit of clarity in terms of the politics of this, the idea is if we fund the non-government schools well by the government, so the federal government in this case, largely, we are pushing down the school fees of private schools, so that way that gives parents choice to either go between government or non-government schools. That's the big idea in this case. But
the justification.
Well, yeah, the justification behind funding non-government schools. But what we've found, and probably in this school merger, is that the public, so all four of the schools that are being merged are public schools, and right now they do not have the resources and the funding to be able to operate as four separate schools. And so the idea behind merging them is to pool their resources together so that the new super school is at least viable.
I do find it hard to digest, though, this justification of we're making private, the federal government is making private school fees more affordable, and therefore more children will access those schools. Because if you look at one of the schools on the graph here of Scotch College, you know, their annual income is $58 million. I don't see how much of a difference cutting federal government money would really make to their enrolment bottom line. I think when you reach that level of wealth where your children can go to that school, that small amount that the federal government's contributing would be much better spent in one of those lower cluster schools. I think that's where the money really should be going when we're talking about these high spending schools up on the top.
Well, one of the areas where, and the biggest, I guess, factor, apart from staffing and that kind of ongoing operational costs of schools, is capital expenditure. So that might be repairing the toilets at your local high school that are in disrepair. Or for some schools, that might be building a new amphitheatre or gymnasium.
Now, or second pool.
Now, of course, this capital expenditure happens throughout the sector. And within the public sector, some schools fare better and others do not. But just on school fees in private schools, there is the case where a significant figure of these private schools that are receiving government funding and school fees are almost exactly matching their capital expenditure with the funding that they receive from the government. So what that suggests is that the operation of the school is covered by school fees. However, that new gymnasium, that new aquarium, that's potentially being wholly subsidised by the public.
Yeah, it's interesting because in a Guardian article that was done in response to this, they noted that in a survey of independent schools, one in five schools have admitted that they've used the public funding to just serve everyday operations, and they've used that money to be able to give them a buffer to be able to, you know, increase their capital spending. So they're not really using these public subsidies to lower their school fees. Mm. Their school fees are just the same, but they're using that money, which is meant for everyday operations, into capital funding, which is how they are able to afford this second pool, this new auditorium. So they're pretty much gaming the system in a way where, even though recurrent funding, so funding for operational reasons, and capital funding are meant to be separate, there's a bit of a blurring the line, and particularly in independent schools.
Do you guys, like, I am trying to see the other side of this argument, you know, parents of the children at these very, very elite independent schools, they're taxpayers too. They work hard for their money and pay their taxes. So I can see how they would think that it's fair that the federal government also funds their child's school. But what do you guys think about the general public's view on this issue? What do you think has come out of the ABC?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard because I don't know what you can declare to be the general public in this. I'm sure people who send their children to state schools and are somewhat proud of the fact that they're sending their children to state schools, because there are some very well-run and well-funded schools that actually compete with these private schools and get better educational outcomes. I'm sure they're rather shocked and disgusted by this. But the fact in Australia is we rely on this private education system. A whole lot of Australians, a significant amount, much more than in most countries, send their children to private schools, and they send their children to religious schools. So the Catholic education sector does a whole lot of the work in educating young people in Australia. So the general public, broadly, you could say, would support this. They're sending their children to schools. They want them to get the best education. Most of them, they're not sending, you know, the problem might be in the Wesley colleges of the world, but not your average private or Catholic school. And from the government's perspective, these children are being educated, and the government is still contributing to that education, like they should. It's in the government's interest that young people are educated, but they don't have to educate them through the running of schools.
And to buttress your point on the idea of school choice, I think that we, in Australian society, we do place a premium on having that school choice, because that gives us the agency to choose and to put our our kid or our future child to which school we ever want to take them. And in statistics that I've noted in 2017, Australia has one of the highest proportions of students going to independent schools, with only 65% going to government schools, and then the rest of that's at 35% going to independent and Catholic schools. So that gives you an idea of how much we are sending our children to independent schools.
We're going to go to a song now. This is Don't Let a Good Girl Down by Thelma Plum. You are listening to Represent on Sin with Danielle, Lloyd, Gianni and Viette. That was Don't Bring a Good Girl Down by Thelma Plum. You are listening to Represent here on Sin with Danielle, Lloyd, Gianni and Viette. So it's been a big week in Australian politics because we have had the Pacific Islands Forum taking place in Tuvalu. And despite press images of all of our leaders in floral crowns and matching outfits, the overall result of 12-hour talks is that Australia is agreeing to disagree with the Pacific Island nations and New Zealand on climate change and coal. This is the Prime Minister of Tuvalu speaking about the agreement.
And I have to be frank, we had very, very open discussion with the Prime Minister of Australia there. In the leaders' meeting yesterday, we stressed very strongly during our exchange, in fact, between me and Scott, and said, oh, you are concerned about your saving your economies or your situation in Australia. I'm concerned about saving my people in Tuvalu, and likewise the leaders of other Pacific small island countries. That was the tone of the discussion. Please don't expect that we come and we bow down or that sort of atmosphere. The Prime Minister of Tonga actually cried in the retreat. Did you know that?
That was the Prime Minister of Tuvalu speaking at the Pacific Islands Forum, and the audio for that clip was sourced from the ABC. So guys, have you been following this? The Pacific Island Forum's playing out?
I was researching it on the way here.
Yeah, fair
enough.
I'll
be honest. I've read about very many articles on it with a couple of different perspectives, but the general consensus was, as you said, that Australia has agreed to disagree. Pretty much just sort of refusing. They refused to acknowledge language. They wanted to change the language and the tone of the...
Yeah, so the word crisis was removed from the agreement by Australia.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of tension, from most of the news coverage at least, there seems to be a lot of tension between the Australian delegation and the rest of the delegations, to be honest.
Yeah, the Pacific leaders were very... it was actually an issue. They had to go on a recess because the tension got too high and the talks only broke down because the Pacific leaders were being very forceful in their pursuance of...
Yeah, a commitment to climate change and a commitment to reducing the use of coal. So the leaders did eventually reach an agreement on the statement of climate change in a communique early this morning, but they couldn't reach an agreement on the Tuvalu Declaration, which was something that's made by the smaller Pacific Islands, and it was specifically about the use of coal and emissions reductions. We did get, I guess, a small win for the Pacific Island nations is that Australia announced a $500 million climate change and oceans funding package that will be spent on things like investment in renewable energy and climate disaster resilience. But do you guys think it was enough from Australia and from our Prime Minister?
Well, on the program, so on Represent, a few weeks ago, we were talking about Australia's pivot to the Pacific. This was the start of the Morrison era, I guess, the Morrison prime ministership. And he did his tour. Before he met the Queen, he went to meet leaders of Pacific nations.
Wow, that's quite a significant political...
Yeah,
move.
Well, the question was then was, what does this mean? Is Australia actually kind of pivoting itself towards the Pacific? With what's come out of this climate convention, this Pacific Islands Forum, and Australia's kind of response to these concerns and the island government's response to Australia's inaction, it really seems like this isn't going anywhere. this pivot to the Pacific.
Yeah, it's interesting to note. I think, strategically speaking for the Australian government, that pivot to the Pacific was in response to their growing concern by the fact that they were seeing the Chinese, you know, the Chinese foreign policy starting to pivot towards the Pacific as well, with through the Belt and Road Initiative, which is in basic terms an infrastructure fund that they lend out to countries so that they can produce their infrastructure and then eventually pay back the Chinese government for it. And I suspect that the Australian government was pretty alarmed when they were seeing Chinese money essentially flowing into these Pacific nations, and as it was seen towards the start of this conference, they wanted to drive that conversation towards China rather than climate change.
That kind of tracks with the Morrison government and climate policy. It seemed to me, when I was reading about this, that it was quite a ingenuine sort of attempt to address climate policy, which tracks with the coalition's record since Morrison has come in. And now that we've actually, the implication of China's investment in the Pacific, it kind of points to me what the real motivations are behind Australia giving relief funding and infrastructure funding to the Pacific. It seems like it might be even be a sort of arms race, so to speak, in that sense with China to sort of gain more influence in that area in the Pacific.
Yeah, and speaking to that, I think in terms of the money, I think as a result of Australia cutting back its foreign aid budget a few years back, they had to respond to that eventually once China sort of saw the opportunity that Australia was starting to withdraw from the Pacific region, and then Australia had to respond to what was originally a cutback in foreign aid, I suspect.
So this could be a political move against China more so than to actually support the Pacific Islanders. That kind of tracks with the Morrison government, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I would say that China is definitely within the context of this debate. But to take a kind of more realist approach, the Australian government's in a kind of bind, right? It's realistically not going to go to a meeting in the Pacific Islands and completely unwind and change Australia's energy and climate policy. That's really not the forum for something like that to happen. And it's quite rare at these international meetings do we see kind of governments come unstuck like this. But what I would say is that if you are right, if we want to take a strong position in the Pacific, then this is something we have to address. If not, that's fine. We can continue burning coal till the climate cows come home. Where are we at now, Danielle?
I don't think we're in much of a different place than we were before the Pacific Island Forum. I think, if anything, we've stayed stagnant because we've committed something, but in the same way the Pacific Island leaders are still a bit disappointed. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the coming weeks and months, and especially in respect to our relation with New Zealand. Anyway, we'll be talking more about China in just a few minutes. At the moment, we're going to throw to a song. This is This Must Be the Place by Talking Heads. What a band. You're listening to Represent on Sin with Danielle Lloyd-Gianni and... That was This Is The Place by Talking Heads. You are listening to Represent on Sin with Danielle Lloyd-Gianni and Viet. Now, we were talking about the Pacific Island Forums happening in Tuvalu, and there was some mention of how China might play a role in those discussions. We have seen a lot happening in China this week. Viet, can you give us the latest?
Yeah, so China is currently concerned about the state of Hong Kong. At the moment, you may have known that there are protests going on in Hong Kong. They've been persisting since March 31st, which was 4 months ago, to be honest, when the Hong Kong government decided to put up an extradition bill that allows mainland China to be able to extradite suspects to trial for any crimes they commit But this sparked massive protests, which apparently swelled up to 2 million people at a point, and considering Hong Kong's population was 7.5 million, you know, that's a substantial amount of their population out protesting. So Carrie Lam has done in response to that an indefinite suspension of the bill, but not withdrawing the bill. As a result, the protests have swelled and persisted until now. And the big two demands of the protesters are that the bill is to be completely withdrawn. Right now, it's only suspended, so there might be a chance that the bill could be brought back. And for the resignation of Carrie Lam. And so you might have seen footage over the beginning of this week of protests at the airport. And things got a bit violent at the airport with protesters detaining apparently a Chinese national who they thought might have been an undercover police officer. Turns out to be a reporter for state-owned media, and also protesters trying to grab the baton of one of the officers who drew his weapon. So thankfully no one was seriously injured as a result of those incidents, but things are starting to tone up in heat in the protests at the moment.
There was the case of one woman being severely injured in her eye. That was quite recent, but she, doctors have said that she's most likely going to lose sight in her left eye.
Yeah, that's not great.
And that's a result of the Hong Kong police firing rubber bullets and tear gas canisters into subways and such, and there was like 46 people hospitalised in one of those little metro disputes.
Yeah, in the subway station. Yeah,
yeah, and it's really escalating.
Yeah, and so the police violence and heavy-handedness in response to the protests have really morphed the movement, not just in protest to the extradition bill, but into a wider pro-democracy movement with daily protests now in various places. So I would like to pass it to you guys, and what do you think? What is the consequences? What's happening with Hong Kong at the moment? Is this a big movement towards pro-democracy, or is this just pushback against the extradition bill? What do you think, Danny?
I am finding this situation quite hard to read. So obviously we're getting two very different narratives coming out of Hong Kong. For example, Johnny just mentioned the woman who was shot in the eye. The Chinese government actually reported that protesters had done that to her initially, when obviously it was then revealed that that was done by Chinese officials. So I think we're getting two very mixed messages about what this is really about. Is this about, you know, the word terrorism was used a lot in the airports by the Hong Kong media officials, I guess the state-run the Chinese media. And, you know, in reality, it was quite a peaceful protest.
It was just a sit-in. They were sitting down.
Exactly. The word terrorism was used quite out of context there. So I think both the world is finding it hard to really figure out what's the truth in this situation.
It's interesting, given the response of the parties in this case. So the protesters would be saying that they apologised recently about the violence at the airport over the weekend, saying that this is not who we are, saying that they are deeply sorry about what happened, and asking to accept their apology. Whereas the police are defending their actions, saying that it's the crowd that aggravated us, and really not backing down. They're really reinforcing their own actions. But Lloyd, what do you think about this situation that's happening?
Well, I think the seeds of this have been definitely planted long before the extradition bill. And that was one kind of flashpoint in this situation, a situation that will continue to see play out. It's deeply concerning, and I just wish the best to the people of Hong Kong.
Our love goes out to the protesters in Hong Kong and anyone else who is affected by that.
Represent, giving you a voice.
Giving you a voice here in Melbourne. Now, it's been an excellent show today, but we're very sad because Danielle is... she's actually getting a promotion. She is going to become Represent's Queensland correspondent.
Ooh, that sounds so professional.
We're so excited for you.
So we'll miss you in the coming weeks, but hopefully we'll hear from you from sunny Queensland and all of the politics that happens up there.
Absolutely.
Now, you have a song for us, your last song on your last show. What is it?
Well, we are going to play a song called Not My Fault by Milk. These guys are a local Melbourne band, spelt M-Y-K-L, by the way. Yeah, they're a local Melbourne act, and I think they just definitely deserve a spin, and Sin's all about lifting up local Aussie music. So here we go. This is Not My Fault by Milk. You're listening to Represent for the last time with Danielle, but with Lloyd, Gianni and Viet for coming weeks.
And you can keep up to date, of course, on social media, download the podcast on Omni. You'll hear from us all next week, minus Danny. And remember to stay political.